Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Sam Adams Returns. Those anti-federalists, boy, they just nail it every single time. And this week, there's no sugar added to anything. Or some people would say, we're not going to sugarcoat anything going on in this program. But first off, I definitely want to mention to you, as I did in the newsletter, about the no sugar added. And that is in reference to how you can help fund this program. We have two very dedicated individuals that do give some monthly support, and that has been a great blessing and helps defray some of the costs to produce a program. As you know, other programs have a lot of sponsorship, all of that type of activity, or get a lot of donations. We don't. So I am asking that you can contribute directly, and there's a link there at the website to help you understand how you could do that. Or what you can do as well that helps me fund this program, as I've done for a long period of time, all the decade or so that we've been, or wow, over that now that we've been doing this program, is you can go to peppersforfun.com, peppersforfun.com, and you could buy some of our products there. We just released this week no sugar added pepper jams, two pepper jams, a peach mango pepper jam and a strawberry rhubarb pepper jam. So you have an opportunity to either help by directly donating to what the program is doing, or you can take and enjoy the pepper jams that we produce through our company, peppersforfun.com, and that helps contribute by helping us pay some of our expenses, as we obviously are really good at doing business. So that's what it's about. Capitalism does help other programming as well. So let's move on and let's get to the no sugar added or no sugar coating in reference to this week's program. So I'm going to do three segments, as I always do. The first one, we're going to talk about the Supreme Court. Let's face it, there were a number of decisions that have come out over the last 2 weeks that I want to touch on. It's a conundrum of the court, but that's not well, how do you want to put it? It's to be expected. The ideologies that, especially with the leftists, that have gone into our judicial system, we're seeing all the time in reference to a two-tiered judicial system. So when you look at that, you have to go back to historical perspective. You can look at the two primary acts that established the judiciary past the Constitution, that being the Judicial Act of 1789 and then the Judicial Act of 1801, to get a clear definition of how the court became and how the judiciary came into its greater being over the course of implementation of the Constitution. I will always take you back to, and the references are there at samueladamsreturns.net, that takes you into the specific court cases, as well as where you can look at the, what, essays by Brutus, who is Robert Yates from New York, who poses numerous questions regarding what could, and in fact, predictably by him, has occurred within the Supreme Court. So the one case that really, I mean, let me stop a second. Everybody's really excited and all the conservatives are yay, jumping up and down all about, you know, the case on with the universities and the colleges and all of that on the equal opportunity and how everybody has used for years racial preferences in universities, racial preferences in jobs. So we'll comment about that. And the more critical to me, though, was a case that not too many people they brought it out in the news, but they're not taking it to the degree of importance as it should be. And that case is the Supreme Court case on redistricting in relationship to South Carolina. This case is a decision, no decision. It ends up being more of a guidance, and I really appreciate how it was rebutted in the relationship to that decision being a no case, in fact. So what I wanted to take, and there's a link there to what that is, and go back to Brutus in his essay number 12 from 7th February 1788, where he predicts this conundrum of the court. So let me take you to this, and then we'll go back into some of the decisions. So Brutus goes this. He says, first, let us inquire how the judicial power will affect an extension of the legislative authority. So he goes on to say, perhaps the judicial power will not be able, by direct and positive decrees, ever to direct the legislature, because it is not easy to conceive how a question can be brought before them in a course of legal discussion, in which they can give a decision declaring that the legislature have certain powers which they have not exercised, and which, in consequence of the determination of the judges, they will be bound to exercise. But it is easy to see that in their adjudications, they may establish certain principles which, being received by the legislature, will enlarge the sphere of their power beyond all bounds. So when I consider that, and then when you take and you consider what was going on in relationship to this case on redistricting, in so many ways, the court gave in a 6-3 decision, gave in to Obama and Eric Holder in their whole attack on every state, and especially, I brought it up in a program last year in particular, on the redistricting issue and how the Ohio Constitution was amended in such a way that the courts have ultimate decision power over redistricting. Yeah, they bounce it back to the legislature to draw the maps, but the fact is that the courts become the legislature in relationship to redistricting. And that's very, very important to understand. And I think people are missing what that actually means. So you need to go into the references. You need to look at the article that I have in there. And there's, you know, one primary article that I want you to go to that references and goes into what the election clause of the federal constitution is and how it requires the legislature of each state to prescribe times, places, and manner of federal elections. Now, what they decided in this case isn't really a decision. It becomes a guiding factor on how that should be done. And that the fact that the courts now have oversight over those decisions made within the legislature. So that means Eric Holder's group, that's there. I've talked about it in the past. You can go to the references and see it. Eric Holder's group can now sue all those states as they choose and reference this Supreme Court decision to take and help gerrymander in the way that the leftists want to. They don't have to fight for constitutional amendments in the various states like they did in Ohio. So let's jump over once again then to the outrage that's going on out there. You saw O'Biden slip and slumber and, you know, spew all sorts of nonsense again about this whole idea of affirmative action in universities and colleges. Several articles that I have for you to review. A very interesting case that came out in that respect, and I highly recommend that you look at it. But the very critical component of this is that it was on Fox News. The Equal Opportunity Commissioner took, and this is Commissioner Andre Lucas, said, stand by, folks. Stand by. This could be the final nail that takes and puts a lid on ESG. When you take and you look at ESG being that evil on that whole equity and sustainability and governance and all of that component of being pushed, and DEI as the other one is the diversity, equity, and inclusion in businesses as well as in universities, I find that very, very interesting. You need to go take and look at those articles on how the EEOC commissioner talks about the SCOTUS just brought education into line with employment law. Now, that one was interesting. And then goes on to say that there will be more challenges to already illegal DEI, corporate race programs, after the SCOTUS ruling. So legal action. And that legal action, I propose, should be used by those fighting DEI and ESG, which includes critical race theory, in K-12. This should be used in every aspect of education to fight back and figure out how to do that. One other case that I'm not so certain about, I don't know how this one's really going to play out, because this came out as the Supreme Court expands protection for religious employees. Now, as we look at that, the key component for me was in this decision, they said that they went back and are using the language from 1791 as to what is a religious group or your religious beliefs. I thought that interesting that they would actually go back into history to look at the definition of religion and religious organizations, religious beliefs. Fundamentally, what this means is that you cannot be discriminated against for what you believe religiously in working specifically on a Sunday. I mean, the case was really specific around that. But more so, it is giving more liberty to be able to not put up with the wokeness, the ESG, the DEI that is there, that's being pushed on people that do not believe in it. So we'll see how that then filters out, and you're going to have a lot of work to do as an individual. But what I recommend, once again, is to take and go look at the essays that I have marked for you in the references at SamuelAdamsReturns.net. And take a look at those. If you have never read them, read them about the Supreme Court, because I think Brutus lays out what has occurred, what the potentials were, and especially in legislative action. Come on back for the next segment more Sam Adams Returns. Welcome back to this second segment as we jump into No Sugar Added. And you can go back to the first segment to understand why I use that. But let's really get to the nit-grit on this one being no sugar coating. And I'm just going to jump right to it. And that is that there is a great need of reformation in the pulpits, not revival. Revival will come when the pulpits get on the truths of fundamental biblical orthodoxy that is what made America great. No other way to say it. And what I have here for you in the references is that you need to go to the book that I talked about last week and even a little bit before that, 1928 book on the New England clergy and the American Revolution. This is not just a needed read. It's a mandatory read because there is a section here that I'm going to cover, and I'm going to keep kind of jumping into this book over a period of time because I'm finding it to be something that of an exposition that is good for both Calvinists and Arminians. And it's very, very critical to understand that first and foremost, in a section that we will talk about, is what I've talked about over and over before, is the sovereignty of God. The sovereignty of God over everything, including government, including children, including work. Every aspect of life comes under the sovereignty of Almighty God, the creator of all, and through Christ, the Savior of those who are called according to his name and purpose, who has been given by the Father power and dominion over everything in all of creation in heaven and on earth. Think about the Lord's Prayer. Very clearly, think about the Lord's Prayer and the sovereignty of God in that. Now, what I will go into shortly is that dispensationalism, as I showed you in the charts a few weeks ago, dispensationalism came in at the same time that we started to see the really downturn in that concept of sovereignty and in the wokeness that has grown within the Protestant churches in particular. So here, let's go back now and just take a look at what Timothy Cutler wrote in the Connecticut election sermon in 1717. He said this, or he wrote this, and he preached this in particular. God, having made man a rational creature, hath, as it were, twisted law into the very frame and constitution of his soul. Now, there's that soul word. Remember, I did a few weeks ago, I really did a rundown on what is the soul of man. What does that really mean? What is that whole essence of the soul? That is where everything, the whole framework of God is then put into us, but has been perverted by our first parents, Adam and Eve. And we need that salvation of Christ to rejuvenate and recreate that within us. Now, in the book, Alice Baldwin takes, and she talks about that framework. She talks about the framework, and we must understand her conclusions from chapter one. And this is for the pastors in particular that we need to be able to interact with and talk with. And if your pastor isn't understanding this, then it may be something that you need to get really educated about and be able to provide some information and guidance to not just the pastor, but to your elders. So she writes this: "To understand, therefore, something of the source and strength of their political faith and its influence upon those whom they taught, it is essential to review briefly certain of their theological doctrines and also their ecclesiastical polity." She further explains that what in regards to like even what Cutler wrote, that we're rational beings and God imposed that in constitutionally within us even. So some such belief as the axiom of Timothy Cutler seems to have lain deep in the mind of the New England Puritans. So let me review for you, because it's there in the newsletter at samueladamsreturns.net. But this is, again, what Cutler wrote: "God, having made man a rational creature, hath, as it were, twisted law into every frame and constitution of his soul." So that's the axiom that she's referring to. And this was an axiom that was deeply embedded in the minds of the New England Puritans in particular. They were legally minded men. Their theology and church polity were legalistic and had a large share in determining the character of the political thinking. The law of God did not concern religious and ecclesiastical matters alone, but affected politics as well. We don't see that a whole lot in a lot of the congregations out there today, except for a few. There are a few that get this. They conceived the universe to be a great kingdom whose sovereign was God, whose relations with his son and with men were determined by covenant or compact, covenant constitutions, which were always conditional and implied strict obligation on each side. In my book, I talk about covenant and how that came about, the suzerain covenant, and what did that mean, that there was responsibility on each side of the covenant, the obligations that were there. God had made a covenant of works with Adam and Eve, who willfully broke it. Then in his mercy, he made a second covenant of grace, ordaining the Lord Jesus, according to a covenant made between them both to be mediator between God and man. See, God made that covenant eternally. This covenant made by Christ with his Father was eternally voluntary, a compact made between them in council. By it, salvation was promised to men in return for faith in Christ. Christ, by his sacrifice, paid the penalty for a broken covenant, which a just God, who ruled by law, could not but demand. In return, God gave into the hands of his Son, as his delegate, the government of the world. There's government. You got to understand, God operates within law and government. This conception of a covenant or compact as the foundation of divine and human relations is of basic importance in New England thought. I will say, not anymore. In New England thought, it's total perversion. she continues, God, the sovereign, was also a law giver. He had established laws for his people, perfectly wise, just, and good, which were founded upon the nature and relation of things and are of universal and perpetual obligation. Immovable as the mountain and as mutable as God himself, and that is immutable. And Christ also gave laws to his subjects, determined the form of his church should take, and commissioned his officers. All within the context of government, of law. The church is established, and you'll find this in the thought of Reformed pastors, good, solid Reformed pastors. The church is established within the context of the government of God's laws and Christ's specifics, and as enumerated through the Apostle Paul, as well as some of the other epistles. She goes on in the book to say, to the New Englander, this divine law became a divine constitution, a fixed, fundamental law, sacred and inviolable. Throughout the 17th and 18th centuries, it was a frequent theme of discussion, and to determine its nature and meaning and to make it clear to the people was one of the chief aims of the clergy. They conceived of it as a threefold, including the law of nature, the law of the Old Testament, and the law of Christ. There's more there, and to get into discussion on the law of nature alone, that is also taken into consideration in this book. But what I want to remind you of is that then we get into the 19th century. We get into Darby and what he brought out in this theology of dispensationalism was already being chewed away in the mid-1700s and into the 1800s with Unitarianism and Universalism. I've spoken of that on numerous occasions in these programs. Go back and search the programs at Samuel Adams returns.net. You'll see them there. So what we have going on is worse than a theological mind bending of the double U's, as I call them, are those other theological shifts in the mid-1800s. The lust, here's where I go. You got all these PhDs, all these wannabe doctors, all these theologians chasing after PhDs. They're always scheming up something different. And then when dispensationalism, who, quite frankly, the perpetrators, or what I will say is those that really have delved into it so much that have really caused a lot of problems with it, are the very popular evangelicalism, especially among the non-denominational Bible churches, a lot of the Baptists, the Pentecostals, and the charismatic groups. I'm sorry, folks. Love you, brothers and sisters in Christ, but dispensationalism has perverted the foundational truths that the early, even Arminians, and obviously the Calvinist truly looked at for the liberty of our country. You have to take and consider that. Folks, this has been the demise through the 19th and 20th century of the church. And we have to return to that orthodoxy, those fundamentals of sovereignty of the living God, sovereignty of Christ over all things. It's revival in the pulpits. Oh, really? Revival? No. It's Reformation reforming the pulpits to understand the biblical truths necessary to promote liberty as those founding pastors did. Come on back for the last segment. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to this third segment. I'm going to tell you right now, we're not sugarcoating anything. No sugar added to this at all. And what's exciting and really has me excited about this third segment is that reasonable, rational people, as I talked about in the second segment, is go back to what did I have there? All right, I'm going to review it for you. Just give me a second because I think it's important that I take you back to a New England minister and what he had to say in relationship to how God has designed us in so many ways. So this is back to Timothy Cutler, and go listen to the second segment for everything that I have on no sugarcoating the pulpits. All right, for you that only get the first and third segment, you need to go back and see that or listen to that second segment. So this was a 1717 sermon. And in it, Timothy Cutler wrote and said, God, having made man a rational creature, hath, as it were, twisted law into every frame and constitution of his soul. Why is that so exciting to me? Well, if you haven't been paying attention and you didn't look and listen really at the first segment and what I was talking about on the ESG, then you're going to miss this point. But I think you understand that from the perspective in that people who are rationally created in God's image and understand those foundational truths of that constitution, that framework in our very souls, are pushing back on the likes of Larry Fink. Because here it is, BlackRock, that great beast out there, BlackRock CEO Larry Fink says he is officially retiring, quote, ESG as an investing term. And this is out of a financial reference. And there are other financial references with this same component that you really need to go take a look at. For the reasons that I talked about in the first segment, is now in particular with the Supreme Court ruling in regards to universities not being able to use someone's race to determine whether they get into college or not. And then the other Supreme Court case to allow for religious liberty where businesses who are woke in particular cannot force all the LGBTQ stuff on you and who cannot force you to work on a day that you want to go worship God. I think we have some really good wins. And I'm excited about them. We just have to be wise in how they play out. But Larry Fink, here you go. But I'm still going to warn you here in a little bit about some of the evils and what's being pushed. But Larry Fink, I mean, he's freaked out about this. He's going, oh, no. Well, Larry Fink doesn't freak out because he's part of the World Economic Forum and all of that, and they just change their strategy as they get these bumps. But God's plan is for man to be that rational being and to seek him. And as I mentioned in the second segment, if we see a reformation in the pulpits, then what we're going to see is reform in businesses, reform in education, reform in how the political world is affected by truth. So Larry Fink comes on to say, and he was there at the Aspen Ideas Festival And there is a large gathering of all of these elitists. And he says that he's not going to use the phrase ESG anymore because it's become too weaponized by both sides, he says. So what's he going to use? We don't know yet. He's going to come up because, you know, these are these leopards that do change their spots. And you know that a leopard is extremely fast and can be aggressive. It lurks in a tree. It's one of the fastest creatures in a spurt. Quick. So think about that. A leopard is fast for a short period of time. Now, we had a short run, so to speak, a few years here on this ESG, and look at all the damage that it's caused. Environmentalism, sustainability, equality, sustainability, and governance, and how to invest, and that placing these to drive corporations to implement social change. That's what it's all about. You know, here he's going on here and he's talking about the environmental, social, and corporate governance. And a year or two ago, it goes on to say in this particular article, it would have been hard to imagine a louder defender of ESG than Fink. Stakeholder capitalism is the term. Stakeholder capitalism is taking in that woke capitalism is a method of taking with the whole World Economic Forum, Bill Gates, so on, this whole idea of taking and pushing all of those social, political issues that do not resonate with rational beings, rational people who fall under that axiom that I mentioned by Cutler, who take and know inside God's truth. But these woke brands. And what I love about this particular article, it gets into the whole idea that there's a blowback. There's something there that's going against the woke brands. Target, Bud Light, you know, the likes of Disney, and on. We can see that there's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of woke companies, ESGers, and the fact that not only from an investment perspective, but they wanted to give people scores all the way down to how you use your money. There's another article says, you know, he's going to stop using that weaponized term. You know, just go look at the articles there at SamuelAdamsReturns.net. Now, one of the articles I got in there for you is that Elon Musk calls ESG satanic and rips into the WEF. Well, I don't know. You know, you take and you look at old, you know, Elon here. He's a conundrum in so many different ways. You know, what is his personal belief system? Who knows? He doesn't get into it a whole lot. But the fact of the matter is that he is criticizing what's going on at the World Economic Forum, Larry Fink, and so on. And this particular article is from January of 2023. And he gets in there and he calls it satanic. The S, Musk says, in ESG stands for satanic. He goes on to talk about all of the wealth is managed by an international investment company that seeks to incorporate environmental, social, and governance criteria in its investment strategy to manage the foundation's long-term strategic reserves. Now, ESG investing has been disavowed by right-wing figures who push back on climate change and all of the liberal ideologies that are being pushed in business by BlackRock, Larry Fink, and such. And excuse that noise in the background, but if you heard the opening of the program about taking and looking at no sugar added, that little bleeping that's going on is letting me know that people are actually going to the website. So I hope that some of that bleeping on my cell phone is you going to peppersforfun.com to check out those new no sugar added jams. And, you know, as I mentioned, go back to the opening, is that if you don't contribute directly to the program, that helps support the program. So excuse the little bleeping going on. And thanks for letting me interject that. But let's get back to Musk. Musk talks about ESG as a scam. It's phony social justice warriors. Wow. That's amazing. Musk has taken that position. And he's talked specifically the backlashes for their policies on BlackRock. BlackRock, which manages $8.5 trillion in assets, has come under fire because of these policies. The whole leftist nonsense on climate change agenda. Straight treasurers from Republican states are taking and pulling their money out, withdrawing, you know, $1 billion in funds from BlackRock and moving it somewhere else for investment. This, you know, out of all those trillions, you think a billion is, you know, a drop in the bucket, really, for Larry Fink. But it does have an effect when you're looking at how many billions make up 8.5 trillion. Go do the math. Go check it out. But I think it's amazing. You had Musk. But in these last few minutes, don't forget to look at how the World Economic Forum is pushing and continuing what? ESG, DEI. They're not stopping. They won't stop. So when you start to think about all of that, let's look at something very interesting that came out in February of 2023. The World Economic Forum, without AI, without artificial intelligence, won't meet its ESG goals. So here is that leopard changing its spots again and moving to how to use artificial intelligence to push their agenda. So they're going here with these examples in this particular article. They're at samueladamsreturns.net. That's in today's posting for this program. Here's how it's going to help. So AI can help by setting a realistic ESG roadmap, developing meaningful goals, all of that, monitoring its progress, looking at those fundamental changes, comparing and processing huge swaths of data on the various metrics, and then helping organizations to gain insights and cut through the noise for a roadmap. Increase transparency and accountability. Now that I don't believe. I believe that they'll use AI to hide the truth as they do. Reporting obligations. Greater transparency allows for greater reporting. Improved overall efficiency. AI solutions will be able to do that. Impact on investment, divestments, and M&A, mergers and acquisitions. So they're looking at ESG-related due diligence. So they're going to push that through AI and how to invest, continuing on that investing component and combating claims of greenwashing. AI solutions, which provide good reporting, transparency, and accountability, may also help organizations avoid or combat any claims of greenwashing. You got to go read that article. But the bottom line and excitement and the end for today's program is that you have been making an effect, all because, in reality, we go back to the axiom of Timothy Cutler from 1717. God, having made man a rational creature, hath, as it were, twisted law into every frame and constitution of his soul. That's where it begins, is within our souls and the sovereignty and recognizing the sovereignty of the living God and seeing reform in the pulpits. Come on back next week when Samuel Adams returns and those anti-federalists got it right.